Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4.
Welcome to Master Tapes. That's a Richard Thompson playing one of the standout tracks from the 1991 album Rumour and Sigh. It's a record that showcases the sort of brilliantly bittersweet songs which started with Fairport Convention in the 1960s and which he continues writing to this day. Songs such as Why Must I Plead, I Feel So Good, and 1952 Vincent Black Lightning.
Since James, in my opinion, there's nothing in this world beats a 52 Vincent and a red-headed girl. And I feel already mine.
Richard Thompson, welcome to Master Tapes. In this programme, we're focusing on Rumour and Sigh, which was the 12th studio record that you'd made since you'd left those folk rock pioneers Fairport Convention exactly 20 years earlier. And we got a hint in the montage of the characteristic lyrical twists and the barbs and that very inventive guitar playing that we've heard all the way through your work. And Rumour and Sigh, the fifth solo album in the wake of the six that you made with your former wife, Linda. And it went on to become the best-selling record of your whole career. Now, best-selling doesn't always mean best record, of course.
That's
but how do you regard it?
I think it's one of the best. I don't have favourite children. You're not supposed to do that, are you? So I tend to have three or four or five that I like a lot and not take it any further than that, really. But I think it's a good record. And I like the songs. I mean, there's probably six, seven songs on Rumour and Sigh that I still play very regularly.
And when you look back on albums, how do you judge a success of a record?
20 years later is the best way. Because at the time, you're always trying to make the best record that you can. There's no such thing as filler. You never put filler on a record. You really think that every track deserves to be there. But your judgment isn't perfect, so you know, 3 months down the road after a record is released, you might think, well, perhaps I shouldn't have put that particular track on. And then 6 months down the road, you're thinking, well, there's two of those tracks I shouldn't have put on that record. And then 5 years later, you're thinking, well, half of those songs really aren't very good. And, you know, 20 years later, you know, there's the three songs you think actually should have been on the record and the rest, you know, probably not.
A Rumour and Sigh, lyrically, I talked about the twists and the barbs, and there's a lot of, as ever with your work, songs about failed relationships, twisted personalities. It's pretty dark thematically, isn't it?
Well, they just seem like normal people to me. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know who you hang out with, but it sounds like my immediate family more than anything else. Well, you know, I
undercut with a sense of humour. I mean, a very darkly comic sense of humour.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. You know, I grew up listening to a lot of traditional folk music where there's a lot of incest, not just a bit. I mean, lots of incest, lots of murder. You know, particularly within the family. So, to me, pop music has always seemed a bit fluffy. You know, even the Velvet Underground just seems like, you know, pretty fluffy to me compared to those dark traditional ballads. The songs I'm writing, I don't think are particularly dark. To me, it's just normal. And we should also remember, I suppose, that people don't always reveal themselves under normal circumstances. And as a songwriter, you haven't got 800 pages like Henry James to sort of slowly uncover the personalities of the protagonists. You've got three verses. So if you put people in extreme situations, then they're going to reveal themselves much quicker anyway. So that's a kind of songwriting technique.
And you say you grew up with folk music. You grew up in North London.
Yeah.
And your father was Scottish. And he was a musician himself, wasn't he?
He was a very bad musician, yeah.
Guitarist?
Amateur guitarist. You know, played in the Police dance band. You can imagine what that was like.
Holy cow. He was a detective. He was a Scotland Yard detective.
Yeah, but he had some taste. So in his record collection, he had, you know, Louis Armstrong Hot Fives. He had Les Paul records, which is, to me, was incredibly important.
Yeah.
So I grew up listening to guitar players.
And did he sit you down and say, this is the sort of stuff you have to learn, you have to know?
He knew three chords, but three wrong chords. I mean, it wasn't C, F, and G, so you could play Rambling Boy or something. It was E ninth, C flat five plus 11. You know, sort of jazz chords, but he only knew like three jazz chords. So it's always kind of sort of stuff, you know. Not that many. Sorry, not that many. Three. So that wasn't really much use if you wanted to play Apache, was it? Really. So you know.
And you formed a band at school, Emil and, well, and the Detectives, in fact. I mean, that wasn't a reference to you, Dad.
No.
And which featured Hugh Cornwell, who went on to.
Yeah, I'm not sure that wasn't
because
we had a different name every week. We used to rehearse for an hour and then spend the next 4 hours deciding what the name was. This is We had to get our priorities right. Yes, Hugh was in the band. Hugh played bass. And we used to do, you know, school dances and we'd do parties and stuff. It was great fun. We used to do sort of R&B covers. So I did that for a couple of years with Hugh, and then I met the guys who became Fairport.
And, of course, that's a band name which was decided by the location, because it was Simon Nicol. His house, his father's house, was called Fairport. Very famous story. Everybody in this room knows it. Could it recite it far better than me? But that's where Fairport
you, sir,
convention...
You, sir, do you know that?
And, of course, and so those rehearsals were the conventions then.
Yes, well, we used to convene there. So,
used to convene.
Yes, gosh, what a brilliant connection there, yes.
But did you know, as soon as you started Fairport Convention, did you know that something special was going on then those rooms?
No. We're just, you know, a bunch of suburban lads. I mean, you know, we were fans of music. Like most people who form a band, we just love music and we love to play it. And we played the music of our heroes. And at that time, it was the Loving Spoonful and the Byrds, you know, and the Butterfield Blues Band and stuff. It was mostly imported. And then fairly soon, we got into songs. We became very interested in lyrics and we became a real lyric-conscious band. So we started to do like the most obscure Bob Dylan songs we could find. We went to Joni Mitchell's publisher and they said, oh, here, have these acetates. Joni hasn't made a record yet, but I'm sure she'd love you to have these. So we heard all these Joni Mitchell songs before anybody else did. Richard Farina, who's, you know, not that well known, really. We used to do Richard Farina songs, Leonard Cohen songs. He's quite well known now. It was all about the lyrics. That was our focus. So I think we wanted to be different.
And you became totally different and distinctive, with Leech and Leaf, because then you start looking back to the traditional, the great English folk songbook, and then updating that sound. But even on that record, your guitar playing is totally idiosyncratic. I mean, it doesn't traditionally fit the blues scales, and it's not traditional folk guitar playing. And you're finding your own scales and your way around the fretboard in a way that I think nobody else was doing.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? Do you trace it back to the music your dad was listening to?
Very possibly. I mean, I always listened to a wide selection of music, starting with Les Paul, Django, you know, in my dad's collection, then The Shadows. But then, you know, you could see folk music on TV, you know, Steve Bembo, Robbie Hall, Jimmy McGregor, you know, on TV.
But there's sometimes an atonality as well to your playing, and almost a sort of Arabic or kind of Indian scales that you're following.
I can't really...
Exactly like that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, were you playing by instinct or were you working this out? Were you looking at sheet music or listening to other records? I mean, were you just literally following your instincts?
You know, I did all that. I took classical lessons when I was about 12 for about a year, and that was good for my fingers, and it started me reading music. And then, you know, I got interested in music theory, so I went straight to people like John Cage. And then when I left school, I took a job working for two German designers making stained glass and mosaic, Hans Unger and Eberhard Schulze, who are fantastic artists. And they'd play classical music all day while you were working. Sometimes it's a whole week of the Ring cycle, which got a bit tedious. You know, side one on Monday morning and side 31 Friday afternoon. So I could have a certain relationship with Wagner, which hasn't quite been resolved yet. Mm. At the same time, I was getting into avant-garde jazz, John Coltrane, that kind of stuff. So even though I've always been bound by the song form, there's always been times to slip in more interesting harmony into the tunes and into guitar solos.
And by 1991, Rumour Inside, that guitar playing style that we know and so many people love now is well established. And it's quite a characteristic style that you have when you're playing very often with the pick and your fingers at the same time and giving a real full sound.
Well, what you can do, like a double rhythm on the low strings, and then you can add things on the high strings.
So it sounds like two or three guitars going at the same time.
So it sounds, useful device, especially if there's only one of you. It's a handy thing to do. You've got kind of double picking things as well. You can do things that sound like slap echo, like a. You can put in these little trip beats. It's a thing I learned from laziness because I'd be sitting at home watching the TV and I'd be sort of, you know, strumming or something, and then I just couldn't be bothered to put the pick down, so I just started using the other fingers. And it just kind of evolved.
And are you normally writing with your guitar in hand, or do you sit at a desk with a notebook first of all? I mean, as a rule, is it lyrics first and then setting them to melodies, or there's no rule?
I go to my cave, my monastic cave. I think it goes backwards and forwards. You know, sometimes you get ideas just sort of sitting around playing. Sometimes you're walking down the street, you know, and that's better in some ways because you don't have an instrument in your hand, so your imagination can run a bit freer. Because, you know, if you're thinking, well, I'm going to write a song, oh, it's going to be in D, okay, I know what D is, and I need another chord, okay, I'm going to use B minor, okay, this B minor. Then you're already trapped, you know. There's probably 120,000 songs being written every year in Nashville with the same chord sequence. So, you know, it's not exactly original territory. So sometimes if you're walking down the street and you think of a melody and you kind of imagine what the harmony is, sometimes that's freer and looser. And then you get back home and you think, oh, well, actually, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, that's a good note. That doesn't really fit that chord, but it's a sort of a ninth chord. Da-da-da-da. Without the instrument, you've come up with something that was more interesting. It goes backwards and forwards.
And the album kicks off in rollicking fashion.
Rollicking fashion.
Well, it sets the tone and the template for a lot of the album, doesn't it? That song, Read About Love, as a comic narrative being played out in
supposed
there.
To be comic,
with the boy going to his father and saying, in fact, I quote from the lyrics, you know, ask my daddy, when I was 13, daddy, can you tell me what love really means? His eyes went glassy, not a word was said. He poured another beer and his face turned red. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a protagonist in the song, or is that a situation that happened with you and your dad?
Well, you know, it didn't actually literally happen that way, but, you know, my parents never talked about sex. Anyone's parents in this room ever talk about sex? in any positive way?
A lot of shaking of heads, hands and embarrassed glasses.
You know, sex was something you had to find out from, you know, if you had an older brother, you were very lucky, you know, if he'd share some information with you. Mostly you found out about sex from kids at school. You know, and what did they know? Like, nothing, you know. Speaking of Hugh Cornwell, I remember Hugh saying, you see that girl there over there? I said, which one? The one on the left? No, the one on the right. She's a prostitute, like some schoolgirl, you know. I said, how do you know? Because she's got a red face. That's how you know she's a prostitute. There I was for about the next 3 years, like, just totally confused, you know, about girls. So that's what the song's about. It's about being British and repressed, you know, and having to figure it all out yourself.
But interesting, it's a song that worries about love before love is even experienced. And you, your protagonist in your song, have consistently worried about love and relationships. I mean, are you naturally shy?
Yeah, very shy, yeah. Well, I'm not that shy now, because here I am on a stage, you know. But it was good for me to get on a stage. It's surprising how many shy people do get on stage. It's like, become actors, become musicians. If you got on a stage, then that made you 17% more attractive, you know. Okay, 15, okay.
But in that song, in Read About Love, I mean, it's the idea that you have to go to the magazines, to 17, to Cosmo, to Hustler, to find out about what sex and love... I mean, in a way, it's a close cousin of Pictures of Lily, the Pete Townsend song.
I think so, yeah. It's the same kind of thing. Pete's a wonderful writer who also writes about those little nooks and corners of being British.
Let me ask you about what is my favourite song on the album, which is Why Must I Plead, which is a very sparse and spare... quite a soulful setting as well.
Yeah.
And another one of your songs about a doomed relationship.
I mean, there's hope there somewhere, surely.
Possible redemption at the end of the song. But, I mean, again, would the words have already been written? Is that something that you would have then gone into the studio with the musicians and you knew in advance what sort of setting it needed?
All the songs are always written before I go in the studio. Things can change. The biggest thing that changes is usually you lose verses. Usually songs are too long. But I try and have everything ready. You know, from the sort of 60s when, you know, the budgets were small and we didn't have time to mess around in the studio. So you had to have it down and get in and get out. I want to see the Bright Lights album, which we did in 1972, I think, cost £2,500. That's about the price of a martini or something now, isn't it?
In Los Angeles, maybe.
So it's just a habit with me to not walk in the studio and say, I've got this idea, man. And people do that, you know.
But you say that. The song finishes with what is one of the most beautifully understated guitar solos I think ever recorded. And that's the sense of redemption that you get at the end of the song, possibly. But it sounds like it's improvised in the studio.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
And I always think it's important because it's more about the notes that are left out than the ones that are played.
Yeah. When I say I've got my bit down, and no one else in the studio knows what the song is, and I'm pretty sure that song was basically first take. We might have run through the chords once. So this is really raw. But when it's raw, you get some energy. You get something that you don't get after 15 takes. There's something very emotional and exciting about the early takes on a record. So if you can get it right in the first couple of times, it usually sounds best.
Give us a version of Why Must I Plead, if you will. Okay. Are you in the right tuning, or do we have to...
Why, strangely, yes.
Amazing.
All your bitterness and lies sting like tears in my eyes. And a thousand lovesick tunes will wash away the wounds from my mind. You've been seen around, you're a new sensation. You got a better deal and you took his invitation. You've been licking his stamps and taking his dictation. Oh, but mercy, used to love all day and drive all night till mercy. Jealousy used to whet your appetite for mercy. We were low as dogs and high as kites. Why must I plead with you, darling? Why must I plead with you, darling? Why must I plead with you, darling? What's already mine?
Flippantly said you go to your cave when you write, but do you have to sit yourself away? Do you write kind of in a world, or can you write with stuff going on around you? Do you have an office?
Well, I train myself. I have a kind of an office that I go to write where there isn't a telephone. That's very important. But even then, things explode in upon your creative process. You know, Mr. Porlock turns up, you know, that kind of thing. Sometimes if I go away somewhere, that's a good way of writing. I'm quite happy on a beach in the Canary Islands. If anyone has a timeshare. But it doesn't matter where I am, you know, to write, just as long as there's no distractions. I'm very happy almost anywhere.
But you live in Los Angeles, in Santa Monica, a sun-drenched, beautiful location, and so many of your songs are kind of drizzly and rainy and cold and miserable.
Yeah.
I mean, there seems to be a kind of disconnect between where you are, I presume where you're writing a lot of those songs, and where the characters that you invent live.
Yeah, it did rain there once.
Yeah.
I think writing's a lot about memory, and it's a lot about inner landscape that you carry around with you, where you set the songs, where the action happens. And for me, you know, that can be somewhere bleak and very British, somewhere foggy, somewhere suburban and boring. But it's really in a sunny place, some sort of, you know, Bronte hell somewhere. And I don't know why that is. I really don't know. You know, I don't analyse it too much. And it isn't always stated in the song. It's just what I'm imagining, you know, rather than what you actually hear as a listener.
There's suggestion very often in the song, though, isn't there? I often think of the characters as British, as living in 1960s North London, and that's taking you back as the writer to where you're growing up, and as you say, it's all about memory. And I mean, do you see the characters playing out scenarios when you're writing?
Absolutely, yeah. For me, it's very visual, and I try to make the songs visual. I think that's very important, and I try to use, you know, reference to the senses to pull people into the song, sight, sound, smell, you know, these things are very important, I think, to a songwriter, to get you in there quickly. Because, you know, the modern song, it's like 3 minutes, 4 minutes, so you've got a few verses in which to tell the story. Whatever you can use as a technique to get into the song quickly, I think is very useful, advantageous.
You've done shows, Richard, where the audience just springs songs on you. You do the request show. How many songs are kind of hardwired into your brain, do you think, that you could just play at the drop of
a hat? It's not that many. Gosh, I don't know, 50, 70? Which isn't not many. I mean, I've written about 400 and something, so that means I'm not remembering most of them, which is quite bad. You know, the request shows I do, it's like any song. It's not just my songs. That's particularly masochistic and hair-raising.
Yeah. I'm not going to spring it on you, but those songs that you haven't played for years, maybe since you wrote them, if somebody said, could you play that for me now, how long would it take you to feel your way back into those songs? Are they buried somewhere?
Yes, they're buried there somewhere, but in some cases, you know, there's whole sections of a song I can't remember. I'll start playing something and I'll get to the bridge. That's the middle eight or the next bit. And I'll completely forget it. I won't know where to go. Sometimes I'll know verse one and then I forget the lyrics for verse two, etc. So if someone said, you know, I really want you to play that song, I'd have to go home and listen to it and relearn it. It's actually hard to keep everything in your brain.
I'm going to ask you about a song that you've probably played thousands of times, which is hardwired into your brain. Probably the best-known song on Rumour's side, which is 1952 Vincent Black Lightning, which is a narrative story about the bad boy on the motorbike and the red-haired girlfriend riding down to Box Hill in Surrey. And I mean, it couldn't be further from Los Angeles in tone, that song, could it?
I hope not. That's a good thing. Although it's become adopted by bluegrass musicians. It was Bluegrass Song of the Year, which is unbelievable. No, it was. As recorded by the wonderful Del McCoury. People now think it's a traditional bluegrass song, which I think is great. It's fantastic. They did change Box Hill to Knoxville, which I think
is... Oh, really?
Right. Yeah. But I would never have thought of that. That's absolutely brilliant.
That's great.
You know,
have you borrowed that when you've been doing it there?
No, never. I wouldn't do that. That's too cheap.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the traditions are not that far apart. Obviously, you know, traditional Scots-Irish music went over to the Appalachian Mountains and evolved into old-timey music and bluegrass music. So melodically, rhythmically, the musics are very close. So it's easy to adopt from one to the other.
And would the song start with the image of the motorbike? Was that the launching off point for the writing of the lyrics?
The song started with frustration, as so many of my songs do. So much of my life is frustration. It started with this idea that so much British music is imported. You know, the ideas are imported, the style is imported. And a lot of the subject matter is imported. You know, the places, the style of transportation. If you're an American writer and you just think of a place name, you know, Memphis, and then you think of an object, a Cadillac. Okay, Memphis Cadillac. I've written it. Just, you know, fill in a few blanks and you're done. It's unbelievable. So easy. You can't do that in Britain. You know, you can't do it with, you know, Scunthorpe Corsair. Doesn't have quite the the ring to it, does it? So I thought, well, let's start with the objects. There must be a British, you know, mode of transport, yeah, something that's sexy and desirable and mythological. And I thought, well, when I was a kid, you know, the Vincent motorcycle was the really good one. That was the one of my neighbours had. He had a Vincent Rapide, and I just thought that was the most beautiful thing because it was all black, fantastic-looking thing, and very, very fast. And I thought, well, I could build a song around that. That's the whole idea, is that the motorcycle is this kind of lodestone around which the action happens.
Yeah, so it starts with a great British motorbike, and then you use the great British ballad form, structure, to build the story. So you've got the narrative builds with... It's the 21-year-old kid, James Avey, who's the tearaway, and the flame-haired sweetheart, Red Molly.
Yeah.
And he's acquired the motorbike by robbing people and meets a bloody end.
Well, he has to, doesn't he? Yeah.
It's a romantic cautionary tale, then.
It's a classic ballad, really. I suppose he has to die. That's just the way it goes, because he's he's bad, and it's romantic, so you have to have a bit of a Bonnie and Clyde kind of ending. But she survives. She inherits the bike, so she's OK. I keep getting letters and emails from people called Molly, with red hair, who claim the song is about them, which is very interesting. There's actually a woman in Los Angeles who has a Vincent in her living room, and she's red-haired, and she's called Molly.
Right.
I don't know which came first. I think the song came first. And then she became a redhead, and then she became Molly.
So that happened... That one is set on the North London streets where you grew up, though. It's in the 1960s.
It's based in South London rather than North London, isn't it? I think. Box Hill's in Surrey, isn't it?
You can get there from North London.
You can get there from North London. Yes, you can get there from North... You can get there from anywhere, actually.
I wonder also, is there a link back to the second song on the album is I Feel So Good? And that song features a tearaway character as well. One that's just come out of jail and he's hitting the town in his sharp suit with a suitcase full of £50 notes.
Yeah.
Is that James Avey again?
No, I don't think so. Well, somebody slightly different, I think. He's a bit more damaged than James Avey. These songs are fiction. They're not based on anything or anybody I know. I'm just making up stories. And probably you read the papers and 2 years later you regurgitate something, you know, about somebody. I don't know what I'm doing, is what I'm trying to say. You know, I don't have a plan. You know, I sit down to tell a story and I just start writing and I think, well, that's fun. And guess what? That rhymes with that. Look where we are now. And then suddenly you do have a story developing. Mm.
And did you know, because, I mean, it is now regarded as one of the classics, it's one that's always requested at your shows and you're always still happy... Well, I hope you're happy to play, because we're going to ask you to play it out of the program. Did you know at the time this is something special? Is there something when you write a song like that that goes on to become a classic that you think, oh, come on, this one's pure gold?
At the time of writing, I've no idea. There's some self-satisfaction about writing what you think is a good song, but you don't really know until you play it in front of an audience, and the audience lets you know if something is being communicated. And a song is only good if other people get what you're singing about. I've written songs where I've played them to an audience, and you get some lukewarm applause, and you think, there's something wrong with that, that wasn't good. You know while you're singing it, because you hear it through the ears of the audience for the first time. This is something that you just can't get sitting at home. So it's why I love to road test songs before they get recorded. That's the real acid test.
Well, you're going to play us out of this part of the programme with 1952, Vincent Black Lightning.
Okay.
That's all for this part of the programme. But for now, Richard Thompson, thanks for joining us on Master Tapes.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot more to discuss with Richard Thompson about his album Rumour and Sigh and its legacy. In the second part, the B-side, our studio audience here at Maida Vale will be posing the questions. You can hear that tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 on Radio 4. Of course, this edition will be available to download and to listen to via the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, where you can also see videos of some of the exclusive performances from this and previous series. And you can tweet about this programme using the hashtag Master Tapes. Richard, we've heard the story behind Vincent, Black Lightning, 1952. Now let's hear the song.
It's a fine motorbike. No girl could feel special in any such like. Says James to Red Molly, my hat's off to you. It's Vincent Black Lightning 1952. And I've seen you at the corners and cafes, it seems. Red hair and black leather, my favorite color scheme. And he pulled her on behind. And down to Box Hill they did ride.
And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.